In this episode, we will learn how managers and their teams can navigate the uncertainty and disruption that comes from mergers, acquisitions, and other business transformation. Let's get started. Struggling to land that big promotion or find that perfect new job? Looking for strategies and practical steps to help you succeed? This is the Reframe and Reset Your Career podcast. I'm your host, Harsha Baralesa, and we're here to help. Thank you for joining me today. Here are some highlights of today's episode.
How can I help this team? What value do I bring to this team? It's not about what I've done in the past, but it's what I can do now to help them in the future moving forward. The clearer you are on the value that you bring, the less destroyed you are by uncertainty. So for me, leadership through uncertainty, different tools in your toolkit. Part of it is recognizing the emotional piece of uncertainty, what change does to people and how you can help people navigate that.
Welcome to episode 76 of the Reframe and Reset Your Career podcast. Our guest today is Jennifer Fondrevet. Before we begin, I wanted to thank all the listeners of the podcast and YouTube channel for their continued support. We now have over 290 YouTube videos. Please note that in this episode, we may touch on mental health and wellness topics purely in general terms. If you have specific issues or concerns, please contact a suitable professional. Now back to the show. Jennifer is the founder of Day One Ready, a consultancy that advises forward-thinking business leaders, owners, and C-suite executives on how to prepare for the human capital challenges of M&A. As a Fortune 500 C-suite survivor of three multi-billion dollar acquisitions, Jennifer has been on all sides of the deal equation. When her HBR article, "After a Merger, Don't Let Us Versus Them Thinking Ruin the Company," went viral, Jennifer recognized the power and interest in a human-centric approach to business transformation, where employees are at the heart of the change. She shares her expertise as a contributor to Forbes and Harvard Business Review, and as a frequent podcast guest and keynote speaker. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. You sound so official, Harsha. I was so impressed.
Well, Jennifer, I wanted to show that this is a credible podcast.
It is, but and man, you like you moved doing... into smooth DJ voice. I was like, wow.
But anyway, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show, and also lovely to meet up in London a few months ago at Thinkers 50.
I know. Already at the top of the podcast, we're name dropping. Yeah, you know, we were at Thinkers 50. It was a lot of fun. That's the dressiest I've been in decades.
Oh, very good. So Jennifer, I'm a big fan of the arts. Is there a performer, song, book, or film which you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, this one, honestly, was the toughest question for me to answer because I'm a movie person, I'm a music person. And so, you know, the book that came to mind is The Reason Why You and I Met. The book, Dori Clark's The Long Game. I loved her book, and it's had the most profound impact on me because of meeting her. I've met people like you. And so the reason why I chose her book, one, I love that book, gave me hope that it is a long game. You know, when you're a solopreneur, a solo consultant, you can worry about what path am I on? Is this the right path? So I thought her book did an amazing job of distilling down, it is a long game and here's how to get through it. But more than that, even the community that she's created, and it's allowed me to meet people like yourself.
Back to the start. What led to your interest in advertising and marketing?
It's a circuitous path that I'm on, Harsha, because I went to Thunderbird International Business School with the plan of becoming ambassador to France. And my father's French. I'm half French. I spent summers in France with my grandmother. So it seemed a legitimate, big, hairy, audacious goal. And while I was at Thunderbird, again, clearly with the path of becoming ambassador to France, I thankfully had a professor, he was my international marketing research professor, who asked me what I had planned to do upon graduation. And at this point, I still had ambassador to France on my list. Thankfully for me. And he was very kind. He could have been very harsh and said, well, kid, give up on that. But he said, if anyone could do it, Fondrevet, you could, but you might want to have a backup plan. And he didn't say it in those harsh terms, but it was, he said, you're good at marketing. You know, you have a gift for this. I hope you pursue it. Thankfully, coming out of Thunderbird, My first job I got was with J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. Thunderbird used to have a program called InterAd, where you actually did a campaign for an actual product. And so mine was Hershey's Peanut Butter Cups to launch that into the UK, which was quite the hurdle since no one likes peanut butter in the United Kingdom. So it was a fun project and led to my start in advertising. And I was in marketing and advertising for 25 years.
Cool. Well, there's still time for the ambassador of France. So let's
what
not
I keep saying
up
to my dad.
That.
I'm just on the circuitous path, Dad.
Yeah, we need to speak it into existence. So hopefully whoever is president.
If anyone
of the US,
out there is listening who could help me on this journey, do reach out.
Very, very good. So in terms of sort of marketing and advertising, you know, when I started in my career, I was more on the finance side. So I didn't really fully appreciate the importance of marketing and building your personal brand. But clearly, you know, nowadays, it is so important. And I think there are many techniques you can use from advertising and marketing to create that digital presence and your personal brand. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Jennifer, from your experience in terms of branding and how you create that?
What's interesting, because I have a marketing background, I think some of it I do naturally without even thinking about it. First and foremost, and it's interesting because it's more people telling me what my personal brand is than I realized that it was, right? And I will confess, so my mom was a fashion model. And so growing up, you know, what we wore and how we dressed was very important. And I will absolutely acknowledge that I had very rebellious years where I wore the baggiest clothes. There was a period where I wore very baggy clothes, and then a period where I dressed like a boy. And my mom was just like pulling out her hair. But, you know, you have to go through that. And the benefit, though, of having dress be such a part of the family dialogue is that I recognize the power of dress. And my mom, actually, the best advice she gave me was dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And in saying that, the implication was people will think you have the job that you want based on how you dress. So I always, even in advertising, I remember getting teased a little bit. You know, I wore the high heels. I looked professional at a time where people were starting to, you know, we had casual Fridays and all of that. And it just became part of my brand without me even thinking about it. You know, the power of dress to me gave me executive presence and confidence in ways that I hadn't appreciated.
You know, I think that's a really interesting point, because clearly the first time anybody sees you in person, it's your appearance, depending on the circumstances you're in. And you know, the impression that you want to give, that is very powerful. And I know that for a man, sometimes wearing a suit, it's like a suit of armor, because you always put this persona on and you feel completely different.
Yeah.
But also, I suppose, from just a digital presence, things like, you know, being on a podcast or writing an article. I mean, say like your HBR article that went viral. It's on the internet, it's there in perpetuity. And the first thing people will do when they are thinking about you for a job or researching you or vetting you for a podcast is do a Google search and see what comes up. And clearly, if credible stuff comes up, that's very powerful.
Yeah. I'm just thankful I had the lesson early, even though I rebelled against it for a long period of time. When my mom passed in March of 2020, I wrote a LinkedIn post about her, a tribute to the lessons that she had taught me. Yeah, frankly, honestly, that's part of my personal brand. Now that I'm sharing that with you, the other part, I write a lot about mergers and acquisitions on LinkedIn, but I also write about her. And I can't tell you how often people have reached out to me because she had Parkinson's. So I talk about that and the fact that she was a model. It's added to my personal brand in ways that I hadn't appreciated or anticipated. But the point that I wanted to make was in that first post, I wrote one of the lessons she taught me was pay attention to what you wear. It wasn't always be dressed up, you know, always have, you know, the suit of armor, all of that. Just said, pay attention to what you wear. And the story that I share in that post is when I was in college and going on interviews, my roommates would always laugh because they could tell who I was talking to on the phone. They could tell if I was talking to my mom because she'd ask me to describe my whole outfit. You know, what earrings I wore, the pantyhose I wore, did I wear those high-heeled shoes that she bought me? You know, and then she would always say, "I'm sure you got the job. I'm sure you look fabulous." And I, you know, I shared in that post, that's one of the things that I will miss the most, was just her constant cheerleading, and analyzing of how I showed up and for my interviews. Whereas my dad would ask me questions, ask me how I answered the questions in the interview, and then tell me, "Well, I think you didn't answer that one as well as you could have, but you may still have a shot." You know, it's the perfect mom-dad discussion, you know?
And the silly thing that struck me just as we were speaking is that I think if you feel good about yourself and what you're wearing, that vibe definitely comes across in a personal interview or even on a Zoom call. If you feel good about yourself, then that definitely comes across. So sometimes I think
Absolutely.
people think this is a superficial thing, and clearly, look, we're not saying spend 10 hours
Right.
on your outfit. But it is there is that sometimes that outside in. If you feel good on the outside, and say if you've had a haircut or done something nice to your hair or whatever it is, that does come across. And I think in life, likability is so important. I can't make you like me, but if we have people that we know in common, and then you can build that connection. It's like Robert Cialdini and commonalities. How do you find commonalities? And I don't think there's any silver bullet in terms of how do you build a connection, but I think there are all these small things that you can do to increase the chances of you getting on with people.
Yeah, and you make a great point, Harsha, and it's one of the things she taught me, right? In fashion, when she was doing all those runway shows, and I was your typical teenage kid rolling my eyes, like, "Oh my God, can we just get out of here?" Yet I would see the ladies in the audience just ooh and ah over these different outfits. And I remember my mom saying, "Dress is in service to your audience, right? How you dress respects your audience." And I realize that, particularly as a speaker, a keynote speaker, how you present yourself, it's not a selfish act for you. It's an act and a gesture in service to your audience. And that really stuck with me. And that, exactly as you said, how you think about it and the impact that it has on your ability to connect with people, it shouldn't be overlooked.
Love that point. And sort of moving on to, say, leadership, because you clearly have been in some fantastic leadership roles. And many of our listeners, they are either leaders or aspiring to leadership roles. What are the things that have helped you?
That it's not about me. And I would say the biggest lesson that I learned for that. So I was hired by Navtech, Navigation Technologies, Digital Maps, in 2005. Now maps are ubiquitous. You can't imagine, walking out your front door without having a map in your phone or in your car. But back then, that wasn't the case. And I moved to Paris, France, with my husband and two little kids. I tell this story in my TEDx. And literally the first meeting that I'm supposed to have with my team there, I had suggested to the team we would all meet in Frankfurt, where the majority of the team was, but that the Paris team would take a train together from Paris to Frankfurt. I thought this was a brilliant idea. We could bond on the train. And I asked my London-based team member for her to take the train over and then train with us to Frankfurt. And then I missed the train. So I not only missed the train, but I found out afterwards that I had made my UK member travel on a bank holiday. So she was actually supposed to have the day off. And so not only was she supposed to have the day off, she goes on a train. I then find out she and another woman on the French team did not get along at all. So I've now made them sit on a train together for 5 hours while I fly on Air France to Frankfurt because I've missed the train. And I started at like negative 25 with that team. I was in a deep hole. And the best lesson that I learned was it wasn't about the past. It wasn't like I went to an MBA, I have an MBA, here's what I've achieved. What they wanted to know is, how was I going to help them in the present moment, right? They hadn't had a leader in a year. And I, thankfully, because I started at zero, or negative 25, as I said, I worked that much harder to see how can I help this team? What value do I bring to this team? It's not about what I've done in the past, but it's what I can do now to help them in the future moving forward. And as much as I am embarrassed about the fact that I missed the train, it made me work so much harder. You know, I was coming in from the United States. I thought, oh, I've got so much I'm going to bring to this team. But because I had goofed up so badly, goofed up being the nice way to say that, I worked so much harder to figure out, okay, how do I get back in their good graces? And it was about what I could do to contribute to their future.
And I think that's a really good point sort of for aspiring leaders out there. I mean, clearly you have budgets which are set and you have to meet those targets and numbers. But then if you think about the people side, it's really about, okay, how can I help the people in my team meet their goals? Well, firstly, understand what their goals are. Clearly, there can't be an arbitrary way of working, and there have to be rules, and you know, you have to have hours that you meet to a certain extent. But yeah, beyond that, you can be flexible, yeah. And you can try to be reasonable. Sorry, go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, all I was going to say is, and I think I don't think I'm the only one. I came with the belief initially, oh, they're so lucky. I already speak French. I have an MBA, so I'm smart. I've spent 15 years in advertising and then the last, you know, few years in marketing. Like, I got this. And then I face plant. Like, I miss a train, yeah. You know, and I just to say that dagger eyes when I pulled in. So it was a good reminder that you are not all that and a bag of chips, Jennifer. You actually need to demonstrate to them very quickly the value that you bring. Because it had been a successful team, but they had been leaderless for a long period of time. And so I needed to show what I could bring to that group that not only demonstrated the value that I brought, but how it would help them. And so I love that team. It ended up being an amazing experience with that group.
And I love that point you make about value, because I think whatever you're doing, if you can add value to a project and you're constantly thinking, how can I be adding value? Now, even if you're not recognized at your own company, whatever it is you're doing to add value, you can take that somewhere else. And I think sometimes people get frustrated about, I'm not getting recognized and I'm not getting paid. But if you are performing, then eventually at some point you will get paid. But yeah, no, love all those points. Now, moving on to your TEDx talk, which I loved, and also for anybody who hasn't seen it, check out what Jennifer's wearing.
Peacock feathers, yeah. Yes.
Cool. That's a good look.
I did a post about that where I started it by saying, my dad said, I'm sorry, can you repeat that? Did you say you're dressing up as a bird for your TEDx talk? Because my, you know, he lives in Madrid, so I'm sure he thought maybe the connection's bad.
I love the theme about sort of managing uncertainty. It really aligns to what this podcast is about. It's really about trying to help people change their mindset, deal with a world that's changing more and more. Would you like to just talk a little bit about that talk?
It's interesting. It's again why I started the top of this with praise for Dorie Clark, because Ellen Taff, who I know also through Dorie Clark's recognized expert community, had done this TEDx and had seen parts of my talk and said, I think you'd be great for this TEDx. So she's really the person who encouraged me and nudged me to submit. And it was transformative in ways that I hadn't expected. It's a lot of work, but I also recognize that not all TEDxes are done equally. I benefited from one that was an all-female TEDx. And so they were looking for women's stories to highlight. And so my story of navigating mergers and acquisitions, I would have to say it helped me look at my own journey differently. And it really came through the TEDx, the ladies who ran it, and then the writing coach who was assigned to me, who to this day says, oh, Jennifer, you give me way too much credit. But she was the one who frankly said, you know, wasn't your pivot from a corporate career into the world of being an entrepreneur, wasn't that a leap of faith? right? Didn't you embrace uncertainty doing that? So she's the one who helped me realize it's not just wasn't just my M&A experience, but it was my whole journey where I had embraced uncertainty and to bring my story more into the talk. It was a pivotal moment. And so the philosophy I had about focus on what you can control definitely came from my mergers and acquisitions, because too much time gets wasted when you're focusing on things that are out of your control. So I talk about that. But the focusing on your talent, effort, and attitude as your key things that you can control, that came through my TEDx experience, really distilling it down to those three things. And so it was an amazing experience. Thrilled you liked the talk.
Yeah, and I do like that acronym T. For our listeners, always remember that T. But yeah, T is obviously talent, E is the effort, A, attitude. And I think it's really interesting, especially with the E and the A, those are things that we can really control. We can put the effort in, we can have a good attitude. And especially I think if you're working in a team and things are not going well, if you have somebody who can be lighthearted, obviously not in a silly sort of way, but try and raise the levity of the, in dark times, that does help so much. And they're not sort of focused on themselves and the problems, but they're trying to raise the team. That, right. That is so powerful.
Yeah. And for me, I've done the TEA as part of my keynote. I also do workshops on it. And one of the more fun interactive exercises is the talent piece, right? Because people think, well, I can't control my talent. Well, you can in a way. But the first part is to really understand and identify what are your real talents. Yeah. We all have them, right? They may not be our job description or the school subjects that we excelled at. They can be, I found out that a talent that I have is editing, right? My ability to edit down to a crisp, clear story or a point. But that came over time, and it came from people saying, oh, could you help me edit this? I learned that that was a talent that I had. So it doesn't sound big and profound, but it's made a huge difference, frankly, in my marketing, right? Editing down to the core simple story or message. But the point of that being, I do an exercise where I have people partner up and I have them say to each other, what has someone told you you are good at? What are things that you consistently get asked for help on that you might not have even appreciated as a talent, but that others see that talent in you? And then what are you doing when you are feeling in flow, when you are feeling at your best? What are you doing? And it's so fun to see a whole room of people having this dialogue and really starting to uncover what some of their hidden talents are. Because we rarely, when's the last time you had a chance to chat with somebody and said, you know what, here's what people tell me I'm really good at. It's fun. You kind of start to acknowledge and realize, oh, maybe this is a talent. And so I'm thankful again to have uncovered, the recipe that I did over my journey, the talent, effort, attitude, focusing on those can really help you, turn the uncertainty into something where you feel like you have more control over your future.
And two points that struck me there, Jennifer, was the talent point. You're so right. There are things that you can do very easily, which other people find very difficult. But yes, you don't actually value it. So it is helpful to get that third party, almost validation of what it is that you are good at. So you could be good at small talk at parties or getting on with people or, whatever it is. But that's actually, for a lot of people, they find that really hard. And I used to be terrible at small talk, but for whatever reason, I managed to develop that skill. And now it's almost second nature. And I actually quite like it. And it's that whole idea of being curious. But the second point that also struck me is that this whole idea of storytelling. And I think life is about stories. It's about trying to create a compelling narrative about yourself and about your journey and how you got to this point in life. And I think, obviously everything can't be a 15-minute TEDx talk. But if you can find a way of creating a narrative about your career or creating stories which highlight moments where you, dealt with difficult customers or dealt with a difficult team. And I think for our listeners, that whole storytelling piece, you should never underestimate how powerful that is because, it's that way of just connecting with another person. And they'll remember stories rather than dry facts.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's funny, you know, the team I told you where I missed the train, Michael, who's the talent story in my TEDx talk, he was on my team. He's based in Frankfurt. So I have sent him notes to say, Michael, you feature prominently in my TEDx. But you're absolutely right. I think for me that I've actually been told I'm a good storyteller. I wouldn't have even thought that I was. I didn't think that. I'm used to in my marketing career, you got 60 seconds to make a point, three bullet points, right? It was all about brevity and succinctness. This is going to sound strange, but writing those posts about my mom, because I tell stories about her, that's helped me realize, has helped me find my voice more. Writing my book was part of that journey, but I feel like I've really started to feel more confident about my voice and writing those posts and getting reactions from people.
Just love that. So, moving on to your book, love reading it. So, why did you decide to write it? And can you give a brief overview for our listeners?
So first, I'll give an overview for people who understand or don't care about mergers and acquisitions. I would hope the majority of your audience is not involved in one. Don't worry, listeners. The book actually is illustrated. It's got cartoon characters throughout. It started out as my personal journey through mergers and acquisitions. As you noted up top, I went through three multi-billion dollar acquisitions, and I've been on all sides. But I decided that I didn't want it to just be my story. And so almost a proof of concept, I started interviewing CEOs, CFOs, CHROs, middle managers about their own experience with M&A. And it became clear to me that there were patterns. There's consistency in how people react post-deal and what undermines the success of the deal. It wasn't just me that had had those experiences. So in the book, I talk about the stuff that doesn't get talked about. The stages of grief that you can go through as an organization when your company is acquired and it's turning into something, but you don't know what it's turning into. And you loved that company. And I use Navtech as my example. I loved Navtech and it was turning into something, but I didn't know what it was turning into. And I say this as the marketing person who had a hand in what it was turning into, but it was just a very uncertain path. So I talk about, you know, getting from denial to acceptance, the stages of grief that you can go through. And I have a Spotify playlist that accompanies that, right? I talk about the fact that I joke that for my bad breakups, music helped me get through the bad breakup. Music's going to do the same for you through this M&A journey. Then I talk about the personalities, the different personalities that emerge when people are uncertain of their future. And I identified 10 of them. Yeah, you know, I won't go through the whole list, but there's a variety of ways that people show up. And so I wanted to not only identify them, but help you as a reader understand, don't become one of these. Or if you do, because it can happen, here's how to get through it. Here's how to manage your way forward again to get to acceptance. And then I would say the through line of the book really is knowing your value, getting clear on what your value is. It goes back to our discussion about talent. Because the clearer you are on the value that you bring, the less destroyed you are by uncertainty. The less disruptive uncertainty is for you because you're clear on who you are and the value that you bring. So you don't look at uncertainty as something like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? You look at it as, yep, just all in a day's work because I'm clear on who I am and the value that I bring. And so really for me, that was the theme of the book. Why I wrote it? Good question. I'm still kind of shocked that I wrote it. I never had planned to be an author, but it is one of those. And I've talked to a number of other authors who've said the same thing. It's a book idea that wouldn't go away. Like I started to lose sleep. I've been asked, like, how did you know to come up with those 10 personalities? And I said, I didn't. They just kept popping in my head. Each of them, you know, everyone from the ostrich to the know-it-all to the know-nothing to the black widow to the missing in action, all of those personalities that just were in my brain and wouldn't go away. And I thought, I have to write this book or I'll go mad. And so I did.
And I like the way you focus on people, because I think with M&A, if you don't have people there to execute the strategy, it's just not going to work out. It's that uncertainty. And you talk about in your book how, you know, clearly there are only a limited number of people who can know about what's going on. Because if it leaks out into the press or it's a public deal, then, you know, that's, it may not happen. So there's so much, so many people who don't know and aren't in the loop. And it's a question of trying to make sure that those people, as soon as, you know, the word gets out, they know about the strategy. And then unfortunately with M&A, there are job losses. So how do you stop it from being them versus us?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because it's while I was researching the book and interviewing all these executives that came forward, that article that I wrote for Harvard Business Review, because I identified that it wasn't just our company versus their company. People expect that. So there's more focus on that. But I identified two other us versus them dynamics that undermine the success of the deal. The second was executives versus frontline leaders.
Yeah.
Because the belief can be, right or wrong, oh, of course the executives are happy. They have now extra zeros in their paycheck. I've now got extra work and no extra zeros. And so this belief that executives are getting more money from this and I am not, there's also frontline leaders can feel blindsided. You know, people who felt like they should have been in the know and yet they weren't. And then there's also the dynamic of, I was about to get promoted. Now this deal has completely changed what the future looks like. I don't know what's going to happen. So that dynamic can be pretty significant. And I talked about that in the article, and I actually do a talk about that now, a workshop. And then the third is the who stays versus who goes. Because for better or for worse, M&A, mergers and acquisitions just have negative baggage attached to them. And people automatically assume there will be layoffs. And they, you know, rightly so. The big part of the media coverage of M&A are the efficiencies, you know, eliminating redundancies. It's about cost effectiveness. And so people automatically think that's going to happen. And what fascinated me about that part of my research was the people who stay envy the people who go, because the people who stay feel like they've now got twice the amount of work. There's also survivor's guilt. Why did I get to stay when they didn't? And then the people who go, they might be bitter at the beginning because they think, well, why did they get to stay? Why was I part of the team that's laid off? So it's funny that both sides feel like the other one got the better part of the deal. And so that dynamic as well undermines the success. And so those three dynamics, to me, I really captured why you see so many deals fail to achieve their valuation in year one. That's when people say they fail, that's the milestone marker, that they don't achieve the forecasted valuation by year one. You know, those dynamics contribute to that.
Yeah, and especially when you have sort of two almost similar teams in an organization, post-merger, then they're sort of competing for their territory. How do you get those people to work together in a pleasant way, knowing that there might be layoffs? It's a very tricky thing, isn't it?
Well, and it's why I wrote about the personas.
Yeah.
Because when people are uncertain of their future, you see a different side of them.
Yes.
You don't even have to be in a merger and acquisition. Here's my proof point for you. Think about back to the pandemic, that year of 2020. And I said, I'm not trying to give you PTSD, but just think back. Yeah. How many times did people react in a way that you never imagined that they would act that way? Because they were uncertain. They were scared, right? There was fear. And a lot of those same dynamics are what happens in a merger and acquisition or any business transformation, Harsha. Like I have seen this play out, and people who have read my book didn't necessarily go through an M&A. They've gone through transformation. They've dealt with uncertainty and have said to me repeatedly, you bringing those personalities to life just helped me to realize I wasn't the only one that saw people around me acting in ways that I hadn't anticipated. So I find that as a leader, it's imperative, particularly as a leader who is trying to lead your team through uncertainty, that you have to acknowledge that people will show up differently and you need to meet them where they are. I think there's often this, hey, these are objectives. Now we just got to go and execute. I saw that fail repeatedly in mergers and acquisitions. You have to understand the emotional journey people can be on, you know, the stages of grief that I talked about. So for me, leadership through uncertainty, it's a different toolkit, different tools in your toolkit. And part of it is recognizing the emotional piece of uncertainty, what change does to people and how you can help people navigate that.
No, I just love that. And I suppose looking at the employee you know, rather than the leader, I think from that individual employee's perspective, it's thinking about, and you've mentioned this before, look at what you can control, you know, doing as good a job as you can do. Think about the value that you are creating, because mm-hmm. you know, even if you do get laid off, then at least you can say to a future employer, these are the things that I can bring to your team. This is how I've added value in my previous role. Whereas if you have this very negative mindset and you're just sort of going through the motion, firstly, you're not creating value. So you've got more chance of being laid off. But also you're in this very very negative headspace when you do go and interview with a potential employer. So I think there are many things that you can be doing to enhance, you know, firstly, the ability to stay in that company, but also if you're looking for a new job, and then also record it. Because I think sometimes we forget about the things that we do. And we just say, oh, I did it, I created value, but you forget. So make sure you're always documenting your wins, no matter how small or trivial they are, because you can use that in a, you know, when you're going to an interview to demonstrate the value that you're creating.
Right. And your emphasis on value is appropriate, right? Because that was the sub theme of my book. And it's what I talk about a lot, is knowing your value. Be clear on what it is. And to your point, right, whether it's a merger acquisition or just business transformation in general, right? Your company's changing. You want to do your values align with the company's values now that they're changing? Like, it's, you need to, don't stay in a company just because you've always been there. As it's changing, you need to feel like, do I still have value to bring to this? Does it align with the purpose that I've identified that I have? And if not, then it is time for you to go. It is time for you to seek where a company will appreciate the value you bring. I absolutely had that. When Navtech was acquired by Nokia, my values no longer aligned, and I knew that I needed to go somewhere where that other company would value what I did, what I brought. And this is no knock against the Nokia acquisition. Yeah. I just had to learn that lesson over time. You know, does this align with my values? And it no longer did. So you're right to point that out. You need to be clear on what that is, because that helps you in your job search moving forward.
And I think mentally, sometimes people feel that I've been with a company for X number of years, I've got credibility, et cetera, et cetera. People know me. But actually, I think the worst thing you can do is to think they're the only show in town, because we can all move and you never know what happens. And, you know, there's loyalty, but and I'm not saying, you know, outside of M&A situation, things, anything can change in a company. Your boss can go, there's right. a transformation, you know, whatever can happen. So you always need to be thinking, almost, it's Jennifer Fondreve, you know, LLC. What are my assets? What are my strengths? Who are my clients? What, you know, what value can I bring? And I think if you're thinking in that sort of startup mode or LLC mode, it's so powerful, because then it's very clear to say, okay, this is how I add value to somebody else. This is how I can repackage things and offer it to somebody else and take my talents elsewhere.
Yeah. And your value can stall. My value stalled after Navtech was acquired. I'd say the first 2 years, I had been on such a high growth trajectory. Right. I had a boss I loved. Things were going great. But, you know, things started to change once the integration really started to happen and my value stalled. And it took me a while. I share this very openly, because you write a book and people think, oh, you knew right away. No. I had to learn some lessons the hard way. And there is nothing like having your value, which was on an upward trajectory, suddenly stall. And it takes you a while to realize, oh, they don't value what I do. And so either, you know, do I become what they want me to become? Yes. Do I, you know, you have to go through that. But it's hard. Particularly if you've been doing gangbusters, right? You've been promoted, you're doing well, things are on fire. And then suddenly you realize, oh, nope, they don't value what I bring. Ideally you can become self-aware enough. And that's why I wrote the book, right? To help people, you know, ask themselves these questions to be smarter about, are you still able to bring value to this new company? And if not, it's time for you to consider what your next step is.
And I think as an employee, you shouldn't feel any shame or, you know, regret about, you know, things changing, because sometimes it's just, you know, that your boss, whoever that new boss is, he or she, the perception he has of you could be different. And that doesn't mean that you've changed. But it's amazing, I think, that sometimes the higher up you go, those small things, the perception, and it can be very slight for whatever reason. You just don't fit with his or her view of the world. And I think sometimes when
you're Harsha, you and I both know that can be hard to digest.
Oh, yeah, right? Totally. Yeah.
You think, oh, I had such a great relationship with this boss. And then you have a new boss and it is not. It can be hard. Yes. It can be very hard.
But then I think it's important for you not to be in a situation where you're sort of worn down by this. I wouldn't say gaslighting, but sometimes it's almost as if people are saying, look, this is the way it is. This is the way you are. You're not as valuable. But you know, that's just not the case. And sometimes you just really need to think, okay, I've got these qualifications. I've got this experience. You know, clearly, I am a valuable person. But just unfortunately not in this situation. In 6 months' time, in a year's time, either I'm going to just quit, you know, or I'm going to be fired. Have this sort of escape plan where you can sort of reverse engineer and think, okay, what are the steps I need to go through so that in 6 months or in 12 months, I'll be in a position to get that job.
You've hit the nail on the head. That's why I wrote the book, right? One, it wouldn't get out of my head, but everything you've just described was my journey, particularly that first acquisition where you suddenly feel worthless. You know, it's like being the painting that went for 20 million at auction now is worth 5 cents. And it is really hard to digest that. But using the painting scenario, right? That's what the market was interested at the time. So at the time, goes for 20 million. Same for a house, right? You know, you can have in your house, but I had it was estimated at 2 million and now it's 500,000. You know, it's what the market is interested in. And your skill set, same thing. And so it was devastating. For me, soul sucking, I think is the word that I used, you know, because you're thinking, wow, I thought I was so valuable. And it's why I make the point in my TEDx talk, don't let other people assign your value to you. You need to know what your value is, because then you can weather the change in market, right? The different skill sets that maybe are valued, because you're clearer on what your own value is, your talent, and how you can contribute that. It just helps you navigate that uncertainty, because uncertainty is here to stay. I think, you know, many of us now have realized we never really had certainty. Uncertainty is the norm. And so for me, having that visibility to go, okay, I need to know my value, because that'll just help me to navigate this. And it's what I'm so thankful when people who've read my book, who reach out or write a review, and one of their takeaways is knowing your value is what helps you to embrace uncertainty.
And also, I think if you have sort of good friends or confidants who you can actually talk this through, because I think it's really helpful, the whole idea of articulating your fears and worries. And actually, once you do that, maybe they aren't as big as you thought. But on the other hand, it could be as big as you thought, or somebody points something out to you. And I think having that back and forth with somebody who you can trust, it's really powerful.
Right. Yeah. You're bringing back a lot of memories, Harsha.
Yes.
I'm gonna have to recover after this podcast.
Sorry.
Okay. Listen, you know, you and I are both in the same place, which is we want our experiences to help others. I wrote a book specifically to help other people. Like in my head, when I was writing the book, I wanted the image that I had was I was sitting on a bar stool next to you. and I'd ordered us both a pint, and I was now going to tell you everything I had learned going through my merger and acquisition experiences to help you be able to get through it. And not just get through it, not just survive, but thrive. And so that was really what was in my head throughout. And I'm just thankful when people say that when they've read the book, it was so approachable and readable, and they really got a lot from it. It's all you can hope for as an author.
Because I think the feeling I get from your book and hopefully also from this podcast that we're doing is that it's all about how people clearly look. Everything is not always not going to go your way, but I think as you're saying, if you do realize your value, you do realize that you have more control than you realize in life. Then whatever happens, to a certain extent, you've got a framework whereby you can deal with it. And say unfortunately, if you lose your job tomorrow, hopefully the things that we're saying will help people. Clearly you have to grieve and you have to allow yourself to mourn, because even if it's the worst job in the world, it's still a loss. But then there's a pathway to getting back, meeting people, networking, and trying to rebuild your career. And I think that's hopefully what we're both trying to do.
Yeah. What I'm most thankful for is the number of connections I have made throughout my career. How many people who, even early in my career, who've read the book or have heard me on a podcast have said, Jennifer, you're still the same. Like, you haven't changed. And they say it thankfully, they say it in a good way. That I haven't burned bridges. I mean, I still have people who I know from my advertising days. Your commentary about connections and your network, to me, I'm thankful for the network that I've built over time. It's made me who I am.
Well, brilliant. Jennifer, I realize that we're running short on time. So before I forget, how can people get hold of you? Because I know you've got your website, you're on LinkedIn, I'm sure you're on Instagram. How can people get in touch with you and then get hold of your book?
Two best ways to follow me. So I am very active on LinkedIn. For those listeners who think, oh, I don't want to listen or read a lady who writes about mergers and acquisitions, I don't just write about M&A. I share stories from my mom, life observations. So Jennifer J. Fondreve, I am the only Jennifer J. Fondreve in the world. You won't accidentally be following someone else. And then my website, jenniferjfondreve.com. Is available wherever you shop for books. Most people look on Amazon. It's a bestseller on Amazon. A lot of competition in the M&A, inspirational M&A books. So fortunately, mine's pops to the top. And the book's called Now What? A Survivor's Guide for Thriving Through Mergers and Acquisitions.
But yours is the only one with illustrations and Spotify playlists. So that's
it is.
even greater reason to check it out.
Thank you. Thank you, Harsha. It's always nice to be interviewed by someone who's so enthusiastic about, what you've done. It's always a pleasure. It actually makes you appreciate your work that much more.
Cool. Oh, and one final thing. Is there anybody you'd like to give a shout out to who's helped you in your life or your career? Just one or two people, not an Oscar speech.
Yeah. Well, my illustrator. Jeff York, we met when I worked in advertising, brilliant illustrator. As much as I love my written word, the illustrations that he did to help me bring the stages of grief to life, and then my 10 personas, they're spectacular. They're now part of my keynote. I have huge poster boards that I put up around a room, and I have Jeff York to thank for that.
Yeah, and I do love the power of illustration and pictures because it does encapsulate these very big ideas. So, yeah, I love the way that he turned your ideas into art. So, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. He did a spectacular job.
Fantastic. So, Jennifer, we've got just a couple of minutes. Is there any final thing you'd like to share with our listeners before you leave?
I feel like we covered so much. For me, if there was any final word of wisdom, and it's a question that I get asked a lot by CEOs, like, what's the one thing that you would tell leaders to do when they're going through, about to do a merger and acquisition? Have respect for the other side, right? Respect, coming to that partnership with respect. And the reason why I say I'd end on that word of wisdom, because to me, that's just a great mantra and way of being, period. It's not just for a merger and acquisition. Having respect for the other side, we talked about how you dress, you know, and how my mom cast that as that's respecting your audience. It's showing your audience you respect them. And so having that in my head, the power of respect and the benefit that has brought to me, the reactions that people have toward me when I show respect for them. Gina Cox, who I know you've had on, she does a talk about that, and she and I bonded over the power of respect. So I think that would be, if I was to leave on a note, it would be the power of respect. Have respect for yourself and your audience.
Well, Jennifer, it has been so much fun talking with you. You take care.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening and staying to the end. That was such a fun interview. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, please subscribe to the podcast, which is available on your favorite providers, and subscription is free. If you wish to learn more about any of the resources mentioned in this episode, please take a look at the show notes, which are available online. Thanks once again for listening. Wishing you success with your career. I hope you will join me again in the future.